Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, S.E. Flinor, and I am super pumped today. We have a super special guest host here with us. We have the lovely Maria Dong. Hi, Maria. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Fantastic. So happy to have you here guest hosting. And you were just on the pod last month. Ah!
It was the pinnacle of my life.
And we were like, you must come back. Don't you dare leave. That is actually one of the jokes Stephanie Williams often makes about us, which is like, once you're on the podcast, you're like part of the family. We're like, you know what? Get yourself whatever you need out of the fridge. Make yourself at home. Also, now we have a chore for you. You're going to be part of the team. So thank you for being on. We're so happy to have you here. And I'm going to let you do your part now.
Great. I'm so excited to introduce Mari Naomi. Mari Naomi is an American graphic artist and cartoonist, and their new book, I Thought You Loved Me, is a graphic memoir told in prose, collage, and sequential art, which explores queer culture, feminism, race, class, sex work, and is just unbelievable. So I'm so, so excited to have them here today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay! Hey. Welcome back! Welcome back! Listeners who've been with us for a while know that episode 41, These People Matter, is another interview we had with Mari Naomi. It was actually during our first ever Pride extravaganza. I remember just being so excited you were there. I didn't know a ton about you at that time, but became a hardcore Mari Naomi nerd, which I am still proudly. Oh my God, I forgot one of your books that's come out since we last talked. Okay, I'm going to have to write it down. Okay. I was like, oh, I'm not going to ruin it now. I'll save it for later. I'm just so excited. Oh, I had forgotten. Okay. Yes, so I am a hardcore fan now. You can't get rid of me even if you try. But, you know, is there anything else you wanted to add about yourself before we jump into some questions?
No, I've just been making comics since the 90s. And I also run the Cartoonists of Color, Queer Cartoonists, and Disabled Cartoonists databases. So y'all should look it up if you don't know about them. But that pretty much says everything about me.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. That's a pretty impressive intro statement.
They're like, you know, I just do some things that are amazing, make the world better, no big. But yeah, everyone should make sure to check out episode 41 because we talk a little bit more in depth about those databases, how they were pulled together, how they're used. If you're a cartoonist and you are disabled, a person of color, queer, any combination thereof, make sure that you go check those out both to list yourself, but also to find collaborators to work with. I've used them a bunch of times to find different people to put on listicles, whatever I'm working on. So I think they're just an amazing resource. And I think it's, you know, you tell me where I'm wrong. My understanding is you do this entirely voluntarily and it's probably a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, now I kind of got into the flow. I started in 2014 though. And I pay someone to do like the database engineering stuff. So it's not a lot of work anymore, but I took, you know, thousands of hours to get here. So
it's a little, yeah, you're like, now it's easy, but it wasn't.
A lot.
I love it. Well, today we are going to talk primarily about I Thought You Loved Me, which is your just mind-blowing multimedia brain shattering. I guess I just want to talk about how much it made my brain change. Collage, cartoon, memoir. I don't think there's any fiction. So memoir, I was going to say novel. I was like, no, it just kind of reads like a novel because it's so juicy. You know, it's like kind of a gossip rag, you know, like it is so many things. And I think, you know, we can't help it. I would love to start with, what was the day you said, okay, this isn't just a grievance I hold in my heart. This is a memoir I need to write. And you do talk about it a little bit in the memoir. So we're going to get a little meta, but I would love to hear, you know, like what was the first piece you put together in it?
The first thing was that was the text that I sent to my friend, who I call Alyssa in the book. And so that was January 7th, 2016 on a Thursday when I said, I think my next book is going to be about Jody. I think I'm ready. And she said, time to expel the demon. So that was 11 a.m. in the morning on that day. That was the very, this book is very unusual in that you're kind of following me along in the making of the book, as well as, you know, me excavating all these memories. Whereas a lot of books have, I mean, it's not that I didn't edit this book, but a lot of books get a lot of nudging and, you know, editing. I edited a lot, but a lot of that was visual editing versus the content. The content is pretty pure. As far as like this, you're following me along into this kind of mystery into my brain.
I think that's one thing that actually makes it really, really addictive and fascinating. And it feels so truthful. Like it really feels, not voyeuristic is the word I'm looking for, but like you're kind of peeling into someone's personal life on this very deep and like a level that we don't usually get to see things, even fiction or prose or even like the inside of a narrator's mind. And that was something that I really just, I couldn't get enough of, like how real it felt, how like truthful in a different level almost.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, it's, I wasn't holding back aside from changing the names. Like all of this was a lot. When I started, I didn't even know, like, is this going to be a book? Is it going to be just for myself? Will I share it with other people? But I knew it was a possibility and I was excited about doing the art. And at this point, I'm so used to exposing my feelings to the world after making memoir since the 90s. Like, I feel like I'm just very comfortable sharing. But honestly, I didn't know if this would have a beginning, middle, and end, like how it was going to work out. So, yeah, the readers literally felt following my brain waves and like following me on the adventure with me.
That's so surprising because there's such a clear structure to it. You know, it definitely felt to me like each of the parts or sections, like I was moving into a new level of revelation. The stakes had kind of moved and changed. I thought there was such a beautiful structure to it. So it's really surprising to hear you say, well, I wasn't sure if there'd be a structure or not. It's amazing.
Oh, no. Yeah. None of that was planned out. As I got deeper into it, there were a lot of post-it notes on a lot of cork boards. I have a lot of cork boards. So, which is why you actually see the cork board in the story. That's kind of like the palette of my brain, like the blank canvas where I'm just moving things around, trying to figure out what happened when and, you know, how that affects like who I am now and how that affected our relationship. So there was a bit of moving around in that I was figuring out like the chronology of things of our friendship. As far as the structure of the book, not really.
It's such a layered narrative. And I think what's really fun is because it's so visual that works on multiple levels. Oh, the layers are layered, if you will. And like literally, you know, at one point I was so moved. I was so moved by the way you used photographs and then sort of used floral print to show, you know, I can interpret it, you know, you might be like, that's not what I was showing at all. But, you know, it seemed like there was this sort of breaking loose or this almost unstoppable sort of flowers at one point are flowing from a photo of yourself when you have really long hair and, you know, your eyes are replaced by the flowers. And part of that felt like, oh, is that seeing life through rose colored glasses? Is that just like wildness pouring out of you? Is it both, you know? And I don't need to know. I mean, if you want to share, obviously I'm happy to hear it, but I'm curious about the construction. You've talked about using sticky notes. You've talked about using real, you know, diary entries. Obviously we know that when we read the book, you know, text, those things, but also how did you figure out how the visuals connected with those pieces? When did you know, like, how did you choose, okay, this is lined paper or, oh, this needs to be four photos sort of overlaid with each other? Like, what was that process like?
That was the most fun part, honestly, of making this book was coming up with all the visual metaphors. There's not one photograph used in here that I didn't put a lot of thought into. Like everything is completely deliberate. So yeah, those flowers are definitely representative of stuff. Like, and honestly, so where I started visually when I was working on this book was of a, I was kind of inspired by, well, not inspired by my own painting. That sounds really stupid, but, it was kind of all based from a collage that I made a long time ago. I think I finished it in 2004, 2005. And I actually put the collage in the book. And it was a life-size collage, double-sided of me. And I'm on both sides. So it's like the size of a person. And actually my cat's in there too. And it took me years to make, where I was just cutting out little pictures of grass to make the grass, pictures of roses to make me and my cat Kitty. And that collage is called Love and Death. And so one side is love and the other side is death. But like, I was never really clear about which is which. But so that's where I kind of came up with the roses. That artwork has kind of a story behind it, in that, I mean, it took so long to make, and it was one of probably the art piece that I'm the proudest of. And it also got ruined by a gallery before it even went on to get a showing. So it's never
public. How, like, ruined how?
So they were supposed to put it in the gallery show. They ended up not having room for it. So instead of just like moving it to the back, the people they paid to move things around, they crumpled it, they folded it, but it wasn't meant to be folded. So it just ripped up the seams of it. So parts of it still exist. That happened a long time ago. That was, 2000, maybe 2009 when that happened. And I mean, I still feel so sad when I think about it. So in some ways, this book is my way of putting that piece out there. That was just devastating.
You know, I feel like so often we talk about creativity, and Maria knows well, we were just talking about this when she was on the pod, is that we talk about the wins. We sort of paint things in a nicer picture because it's frightening to share our things that we're bad at, or things that go wrong, or shit that you cannot control. Like some fucking person folds your art. Like I'm so upset. It doesn't matter that it happened 15 plus years ago. I am so upset. And I just, it's amazing to say to yourself as an artist, like, okay, I'm going to like pick myself up. I'm going to dust myself off. I'm going to find some other way to use this concept or reclaim this art that someone took from me. And I think I'd love to hear a little bit, and I'm going to ask the question, but then Mari, if you don't want to talk about it, we can easily cut it. I would love to hear a little bit about that process for you, because I also know this book was originally picked up by a different publisher.
Yes.
And then that ended and has been picked up by a new publisher and crowdfunded since then. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the publication process, because it seems like you're making a lot of lemonade out of lemons, and that's pretty impressive.
This book, this is what, my ninth book or my eighth book published? It's up there. And this is by far the hardest one. It's had the rockiest road. Rob Kirby told me it was my most difficult birth. And I mean, I'm still birthing it, and it's, but I'm also completely just, I'm like, no, this has to go out there. This has to be in the world. Like, years ago, I told myself I would never crowdfund a book, but apparently I will. Because the book is that important to me, that I'm like, I need this to survive. I don't want to travel. I haven't gotten COVID yet, and I don't want to get it. But apparently, I am willing to get COVID to get this book out. Like, it's more important to me than my health. I would die for this book, apparently. It's like my problem child. It's my little, my baby, who I know is going to grow up to be a serial killer, but I have to do it anyway.
I have to say, like, I'm so torn by what you just said, because on one hand, I'm like, no, don't sacrifice your health for anything, right? Like, but at the same, and especially, I had COVID, it was really horrible. So I'm like, no, don't do that. I don't recommend it. 0 out of 10. But at the same time, like, it is so very special. Like, I just could not. I think that even just with the story you just told about like your broken art, it feels like a book that's more than a book. Like, it's connected to so many other things. It's like almost like an experience that exists in this like web of experiences. And when you're reading it, you get the ability to reach out and touch all of these other experiences, and kind of having that context, I was like, oh, that totally makes sense, because it's kind of how it feels as a narrative. So on one hand, I'm like, yeah, I love this book. You should do whatever you can to get it out there. On the other hand, I'm like, please don't get sick. That's really, don't do that. So I'm very torn.
We're all going to die somehow. I mean, that's what I figure. And at this point, this book is bigger than myself, I feel. Not to hype myself up, but I just don't want it to disappear. Like, it would just, I do feel like it's more important to me in the way that parents, I guess, feel that way about their children. I don't know. I never wanted kids, and probably that's why. But I always wanted books, and I'm really happy about that I have them. But this one, I don't know. This one is so, it is very personal, but I also think it's kind of important, or else I wouldn't have wanted to share it. Not because of my experience is important, but because I think it's important that we share more stories like this about friendships that aren't, you know, there's just such a lack of representation of like healthy or unhealthy friendships. It's just not a genre that has, I don't know, people are so obsessed with romance and acrimonious friendships. I mean, there's certainly some acrimony in this book, but it's not like my friendships don't follow the Hollywood route of, you know, what a friendship is supposed to be. I don't know. I just think it's important to get more perspectives like this out there. And also I think it's important to stretch the genre of graphic memoir and novel some more. I see that's happening more mm-hmm. and more. And it's partly why it was so hard to publish this book, is because it's so different and weird. And I don't expect everyone to like it. I don't expect everyone, to get it, but like, I feel like there should be more books like that out there. And so that's what's important to me, is just to get more diversity into the medium of styles, of, you know, how we tell stories. And I don't know, I sound very self-important right now, but it's not about me. It's about expanding the medium and expanding genres. And I would love to be able to walk into a bookstore and just have there's a whole section about friends, mm-hmm. about friendships. And this is what I feel really passionate about, not specifically my experience, because I'm done with it. Like, I've had it, it's gone. I've processed it with this book. I think it's a good book in that, usually when I'm done with a book, I can't even stand to look at it. And this one, I just keep looking at it and I still think it's good, which is very unusual for me. But aside from my own stuff, like I just think it's important to do all those other things, and I'm going to fight for it. So, yeah.
Well, I think this is partially the unique problem of memoir, right? Which is like taking your own life and making stories from it and telling stories from it and, you know, having them very much connected to reality, saying, you know, I behave poorly, this person behaved poorly. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of people who are like, why you? And it's like, well, I don't know, because why not anybody? Anybody, yeah. I think, can write memoir and write it beautifully if they, you know, put the time into it and do the introspection. And I think that's why it being you specifically is so important, because you are so introspective, because you've kept journals since you were a child, because you've got, we would call them today receipts, but I really, you know, documentation, the things that, you know, whenever someone asks me like, oh, like, how do I get into personal essay? How do I get into memoir? I'm like, step one, you need to keep a journal. You need to keep a journal, because that's how you're going to be able to dig back in. And I can't say how many essays I have gone back to a journal and literally taken a quote from, you know, and it gives you a sort of immediacy with the creator that you can't have if it's just, you know, based in your memory. And memory is faulty. That's another, oh my God, I'm going to like freak out. That's another beautiful piece of this. And I think the best memoirs do this, is asking about what do I remember? Why don't I remember things? And what does that say about me as the person? Mm-hmm. But what does that say about us? How do we remember each other? How do we remember the events that form us? And yeah. I think that it's hard to say, and we're going to go through my story, but I'm glad that you did, because this is so uniquely yours and so universally ours, because it is about friends. I've gone through these hard friend breakups. Maria and I were texting about this. It's devastating. It's devastating to lose a friend that you were like, oh my God, you put it this way. You were like, romance, I expected. I anticipated those relationships could end. But with a friend, I had pictured that Jody and I would be sitting in our rockers as old ladies. At the time, that was the word, yes. Looking at, you know, the world through this sort of funny lens. And I remember having that conversation with a very dear friend that we are no longer, we don't speak anymore, because we grew apart, because things happen, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, no one talks about how much that still hurts. I still think mm-hmm. about her all the time. I wonder where she is. I wonder what she's doing. And I'm never going to get an answer probably. And that's yeah. the other piece that I think you do in this book that is just so remarkable, is you were saying, you know, it's not like a Hollywood depiction of Friends. And the reason the immediate thought I had when you said that was like, oh, in Hollywood, everything, you get these cathartic moments and you get these, like, you're always getting closure, you know? Mm. And there is no closure. For me, there was no closure with my Friend breakup. And I think that's why your book is so important, because even as you take us into the back half of the book, and you know, we were like, oh, we're gonna get closure, and then that last page, oh my god, and you're like, no closure.
I was angry. I was like, good angry, but I was angry, you know what I mean? Like, it hit hard. I think, just kind of jumping off what Essie said here and what you've been saying, I don't think until I read this book I realized how neglected messy narratives around friendship are, because the truth is that for the majority of people, I'm going to say in the United States, because that's the context that I live in, mm-hmm. friendships don't last forever. You know, the friends that you made as a small child are not the friends that you have when you're 40. Sometimes there are, or there might be a couple people that are, but the vast majority of people that you meet in your life and form friendships with, you have kind of an ephemeral relationship with, and that's almost never depicted in media, because it's so much easier for the creator and the story plot to just have these like fast friends that are friends forever, like, period, you know? And so, like, this is this whole experience that we as human beings really struggle to navigate and don't know how to navigate, like SE was saying, because we don't have like a context for it. We don't have like a template for like, what does a messy friend breakup look like? And, you know, what are some of the things that could happen there? We just kind of ignore that it even happens. And I felt so ripped open by this book, in the best possible way, thinking about, you know, some of these friendships that I had that were very meaningful, that changed the course of my life, and are people that, for, as he was saying, like, for whatever reason, I can no longer talk to, whether that's because it's healthier for them or for me, or we've just grown apart, or, you know, we weren't the kind of people that could keep up a long distance friendship and one of us moved. Like, it could be something that simple. But that's actually the most like normal human experience, and we almost never see it. And so there was something so deep and profound about seeing it depicted this way.
People change too. And that's a thing. Like, you're like, oh, we'll be friends forever or happily ever after. But like, people change all the time. And it's a matter of like, are you changing together? Or, you know, how is that going to work? You know, and sometimes you can reconnect and it'll be great. But like, I don't know, most people just go apart and they change. And, you know, maybe you wouldn't like them, or maybe you wouldn't like them if you could see into their heart, or they could see into yours. Like, you just, it's so, there's so many the fact that anyone can stay friends for a long time is pretty amazing. And I do have some longtime friends. And it's like, it's super impressive to me, because like, it's hard. Like, people's lives go in different directions.
You mentioned that too. You were talking about how part of the reason you were valuing your relationship with Jody was because you still had so much in common. You were child free. You had, you know, values that were similar. And I think that's been one of the harder parts for me of honestly getting older, is like, oh, wow, we really do see the world so differently. I thought we were exactly the same, right? Because you never know what's inside someone. You only know what you hear or what you project, to be fair. I've done a fair amount of projecting on friends. You know, that sort of experience of, oh my gosh, well, we had the same conversation and we walked away with it with completely different understandings about how to live our lives.
Really. Yeah.
So I'm curious for you, like, what has been the key of maintaining those relationships? And, you know, how have you talk a little bit about creating new friendship groups and doing that really intentionally. Is that something you're still doing now? You know, you've talked a little bit about long-term friends. I guess, Mari, tell me about your friends is what I want to know.
Well, I definitely have a mix of new friends and old friends. Like, I know a lot of people, especially my age, I'm almost 50. I hear a lot of people saying that it's hard to make new friends, and I get it, but I also, I don't have that problem. I meet a lot of great people just by the nature of my work. I, you know, going to art receptions, or, you know, just there's so much community around me that, around my work, that, it's easy for me to meet new people. But like, I could totally see how that could happen, especially, for people who choose to become parents, or don't choose, but like, who are parents, who are kind of stuck in that in, you know, certain situations, like all they meet are other parents or whatever that they may or may not get along with. Like, it's almost like going to school where you're stuck with like a select group of people, or when you work at a corporation and you're just stuck with your, you know, the people around you, like you might not want to be friends with any of them. But I meet so many people and I feel really lucky. But I definitely have my inner circle. And then I have people who are like on the fringe of the inner circle who come in and out. And then I have like acquaintances, and then I have colleagues. Like I'm super lucky, but it is also hard to find time to maintain all the friendships. And that's the hard part for me, is finding time. But it's also that also extends to finding time to make art or do something other than promoting the art that I've already made. I feel like most of my time every day is spent picking up dog and cat poop, honestly.
Real talk. Pet butler.
Seriously, like I'm taking care of the animals all day. I'm taking care of emails, like doing admin stuff for myself. It's terrible. And, you know, finding the time to exercise every day, like I swim every day, like I'm feeding myself every day, like the basics are, you know, take up so much time. I don't even have children. I don't have, you know, that added layer. I'm not going to school. I don't have like a day job. I'm just taking care of like just the basics, doing laundry. And then like on top of that, I'm like, wow, I only end up with a couple hours to do the art stuff. Oh no, but that other thing on the back burner, that email I have to get back to, or I have to do taxes or whatever. Like, it's amazing that in this society, we're able to get anything done, and maintaining friendships on that scale. It's like, it's not a super high priority, but like, I'm always trying to lift it up. Like I'm always like things that are really important to me that I'm constantly like basically making time for, are my friends, are for going out and seeing art. Like, that's so important to me. And for boosting up other people in the community. Like, these are all things that although they might not be necessary for my day-to-day survival, like I have to consciously make a room for, because they are really important to nourish my whatever spirit, whatever you call it. So I don't know. It's hard to make room for these, like even just psychic space for it. But like, that's the key for me. And, you know, I'm constantly like, I always want to be making new friends. And I understand that some friends will be there more often than not. But like just the other day, a friend, they sent me on a blind date with a new potential friend. And oh my gosh, it was so great. Like I sat out in the freaking rain for like 3 hours and drank tea. And like, we're just having the greatest conversation. And I want to do that frequently. But that's, I don't know, like just making myself do it is the thing. I go to parties and stuff. Like, that's a great way to meet people. Honestly, like, parties just stress me out. But like, I always come home from a party thinking, wow, like I met at least two people that I could potentially be friends with. And whether or not that happens is kind of irrelevant. It's just like knowing that they're out there.
Mm. Well, you know, while you were speaking, it made me think of something that I've also seen Maria tackle in her work, which is like, capitalism makes life very hard.
I was literally going to say this. I was I'm so glad we're on the same level. No, I was just thinking about how, as you were talking, you were basically saying, I have to balance and choose between having a social life that is personally fulfilling and therefore is like a definite mental health need, a spiritual need, whatever you want to call it, being able to make art, which is both a personal need and also the way that you live and make money, and like this admin stuff, and also like just all of the little things that we have to do to like maintain our bodies. Essie and I complain daily. Like, we text daily about like, I can't believe I have to make food again 3 times today. Like, it's unbelievable. And so I was just thinking so much about, as you were talking about how like this, I don't know, like the work week or the burden of living in this capitalist system constantly puts on us, and how generative, how much more social, how much less isolated we would all be if we just had a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. My work career's life radically changed during the pandemic. And I went from having no time to having like some time. And just like that, overnight, it was like I was exercising and my mental health was better. And I was like talking to people on the phone, all of these things that I hadn't done in years, just because I didn't have the time for it. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, like the whole time, like, I don't know, that's kind of what Essie was going to say, but that's like where my mind went during that that piece.
More time. Oh, wow. That's amazing that your mental health got better in the pandemic. That's definitely not what happened to me.
I don't think it's what happened to anybody really, except that I walked into the pandemic with such terrible mental health from work specifically, that I had like internalized it to the point where I thought that was just my personality. And it was so weird because after all of that changed, my husband was like, "You're really nice lately." And I was like, "Oh, I guess I'm actually a pretty laid back person." And nobody knew because for the last 10 years, I've been working myself to death. So I think it's interesting because like my whole personality is different. Anyone that has known me over the last 10 years and meets me is like, "I don't recognize you." And I think, so I don't know. That's what I was thinking about when you were talking about trying to maintain all these things. Because you're obviously doing an amazing job. I mean, your art is amazing. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you have a wonderful life with your friendships. You know, you've got your animals. Like so many things that seem rich and valuable and meaningful in your life. I'm like, man, how do they do it? Because like I was really struggling.
It's hard though. Like, I mean, I don't think, like, I mean, friendships take work, but I don't think they should be hard. And the times that I've thought, oh, this friendship is hard, when I've let go of that friendship, life gets a lot happier and easier. So I've definitely learned to let go of some friendships, even if they were meaningful to me, even if like, I love the people. Like, I feel like relationships shouldn't be hard.
Which is why we need more books where people let friendships go. So we have like a paradigm for it.
But I don't think sometimes, like there are definitely hard parts, but I remember I used to be in this just horrible relationship. Looking back on it, I realized I was in an abusive relationship, but I didn't recognize that at the time. He wasn't hitting me or anything, but it was definitely very emotionally abusive. And there was a moment where someone, a friend of mine, asked me how it's going with him. And the best I could say was like, oh, you know, relationships are hard. And then she kind of looked at me. And she had just the best relationship ever. And I feel like I now have the best relationship ever. And I say this past tense because unfortunately she passed away. But
I'm so sorry.
But yeah, I didn't say anything. She just kind of looked kind of sad. And I realized, oh, wait, does this have to be like this? Like, do relationships have to be hard? Like, all my relationships have been hard. And I think at that point, like I kind of realized I don't need to be in a relationship if it's going to not make my life better. And after that, I kind of had a short relationship that was even harder, but it wasn't at least abusive really. And then I was alone for a long time and that was amazing. And I was like, oh, I can actually be happier when I'm not tied to a person, which was kind of a revelation because I was in my early 30s and I'd always been in a relationship or about to be in a relationship up to that point. And I was suddenly alone and I was the happiest I'd ever been. And I'm like, oh shit, like, okay, I'll be alone forever. And this is going to be the best thing ever. But then I met my spouse and that all went away.
Dang it.
He's so like, well, okay, just this last one. If it doesn't work out, then I'll be
alone. And it's stuck. It's stuck.
Okay. Maybe this is more of like fawning than a question, but I think one thing I love so much about your book is that it had this very like realistic, nuanced look at kind of the line between like abuse and not abuse in terms of like friendships and romantic relationships. Because mm-hmm. in most media narratives, it's like super over the top and obvious, right? This is abuse. This is not abuse. And like everyone knows it. And you know, it's like, oh, I'm being abused. I have to get out of the situation. But the truth is that these lines are not always so clear, particularly when you're in that moment. And I felt like that feeling of like that blurriness, that messiness was so like beautifully captured by this book, right?
Yeah, it's really complicated. And it's most people who are in abusive relationships I've seen don't realize it until after the fact. And then they're like, holy shit, I can't believe that. Like, I can't believe I was in that relationship. Like, I mean, yeah, it's tricky. That's how people get stuck in those situations. Oh, yeah.
Well, I thought you did such an amazing job with it. And my heart really broke for your narrator, who I guess is you, but not you. So I'm like not sure how to approach
it. It's 100% me. There was no one else.
And just the way that you kind of traced this arc between who this person was as a very young person and then kind of moving over. I think maybe this is, I don't read a lot of memoir, so maybe this is something that the genre does specifically well, but just being able to trace that arc and kind of show how like the beginning affects the middle and the middle affects the end, with that context of like, you know, romantic relationships and abuse and even friendship abuse, I thought was just, honestly, it was so well done. It really just, it hurt to read in the best possible way.
This thing that you're describing is actually not something that I was aware I was doing. So I'm very interested.
I was just going to ask you if that was deliberate. So you just answered the question.
I don't want to give too many spoilers to anyone who's listening to this, but I'm very curious about where you saw friendship abuse. That is very interesting.
Right now, I'm trying not to give spoilers. I think that like we have as a culture this idea of being able to see abuse almost like a list of signs and symptoms. Like if you see this, it's abuse. If you see this, it's abuse. But really, on a practical level, when it's happening or when you're in a circumstance, it's very much on a spectrum, right? And we all make these like contracts with each other in our own friendships or relationships on a case-by-case basis as to what we're willing to tolerate, what hurts, what doesn't hurt. And so I think some of the friendships, and particularly the central friendship in this book, was so messy and difficult. And there is some, I guess I'll call it deception. I'm trying to be very vague here. So some deception, there's some
manipulation.
There are circumstances where a person's expressing an emotion and another person is, you know, refusing to hear them, almost like a form of gaslighting, essentially.
Yeah.
And so I saw like, you know, the question becomes like, well, why would a person kind of, the questions often in these, when we have these conversations in society, well, why would a person put up with this or why would a person deal with this? And you did such a great job of showing kind of like the incremental steps in a person's entire arc of their life that kind of get them into these situations and how they feel, how they're reacting. And it makes so much sense, right? If you're like in that perspective, you're like, this makes sense. And maybe it's not the best way to react to something, but it's very relatable. And I just thought you did such an amazing job with that. So I thought that was very deliberate. And so you're like blowing my mind right now.
With some of the romantic relationships, I don't know, like I try to not be too heavy-handed about it because like these were things that were actually happening. So I feel like the diary entries were what kind of helped pull me back out and not just be like seeing it from like a cynical viewpoint of today, like even though there's some of that. It's funny that you mentioned like not realizing abuse as it's happening. Like I was just, as I was walking my dog, one of my dogs this morning, I was thinking about this lecture that I'm writing and it's supposed to be about race and, it's, you know, complicated to write about that stuff. But I was thinking about how the times that I've experienced racism directly, like I always grew up thinking that racism was a specific thing. Like if someone calls you a racist word or whatever, but like, so you're not prepared for the racism that's a little more subtle because the outright racism that you might see in movies or might expect to be as racism, like that tends to be a little more subtle because everyone recognizes those things as racist, but not all racists think that they are racist and they might still behave in a racist manner, but it just comes out like, I guess that microaggressions are now like, that's how you describe them. But like, that was not a language that I had as a kid growing up as one of the only Asian people in my surroundings. Like, so yeah, the whole, like that's obviously another form of abuse, but it's definitely been on my mind a lot lately as I'm trying to write about it.
Well, and I think, you know, I'm sort of seeing the connection between each of these pieces. And then, you know, I wanted to bring in something that you always do an exceptional job of just normalizing abortion. You just, you know, it happens. You had an abortion and it's like, we don't have to spend 12 pages agonizing or whatever. But we're also not going to not mention it. You know, it's going to be there because it's a part of your experience. And I remember that from the Life on Earth series too, where they did have to go into it a little bit more because it's YA, obviously. So they needed to explore it, but it was still normalized. It was still almost casual. And I feel the same way with how you discuss abuse, how racism does come up in the book, where it comes up in just sexuality, gender. And what I think I'm seeing is what Maria was calling, you know, delivering it as very real. It's this vulnerability to say like, these are the real facts and I don't have to dress them up and I don't have to change them. I might present them a specific way. Obviously you're an artist. Yeah. This isn't just your journal. You know, but I think that that sort of unflinching examination of the realities of what it means to be Mari, but also what it means to be a person who is of a marginalized gender, of a marginalized race, of, you know, and the list goes on in this world. And I'm curious, you know, is that just how you've always written? Is that just how you see the world and how you, you know, put yourself into it? Or is that a practice of vulnerability, of digging into yourself that you've developed, or, you know, any other option, obviously?
I mean, I don't know how, like, at this point, I've been doing it so long that I feel like it, like, how I write is pretty intuitive. Like, I don't put a ton of thought into it, but also because it's memoir, I don't really have to. Like, these are just things that happen, and this is how I see the world, etc. This is why I love reading memoir, even if, like, the writing or the presentation might not be polished, it might not be, like, just A grade or whatever. At least you're getting, like, someone's true experience. I love fiction, and I love all kinds of books, all kinds. But I feel like when I want to just hear a story and not like I don't want to have to suspend my disbelief, it's just easier for me to read memoir. And I don't want to say it's easier to write memoir, because in some ways it's much, much more difficult to write memoir than it is to write fiction. But there is that ease. Like, that's one of the pros of reading and writing memoir, is that, like, that part can feel a little more effortless.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if it's effortless for all memoir writers. I think a lot of people would be very jealous to hear you say that. But, I think one of the things you do so skillfully, that is, whenever I'm working with someone who's trying to work on memoir, this is one of the things I talk to them about, is, like, you need to really narrow your scope. You can't cover your whole life in a memoir. That's an autobiography. You really want your memoir to be about a theme, about a conflict, a moment in time, or a thread throughout your life. And you do that so well. I mean, your memoirs are all exceptional. And I think it was so neat to know that you had this huge body of work behind you, because you really do. You do so much. And this was a new sort of frontier in some ways, and a familiar one in some ways. And I don't know. I mean, I just want to talk about it forever, and I'm running out of, like, specific questions, but one...
Oh, I have a question.
Okay, perfect. Go ahead.
Listeners, it's me, your beloved Essie, back to tell you about something that maybe you don't know about yet that you might want to take advantage of. Did you know we're active over on Patreon? We're at a new address. It's patreon.com/queerspec. If you go to patreon.com/bitchesoncomics, it still redirects there for the time being. But we're at patreon.com/queerspec, and we have just so many episodes. We have over 100 back episodes, and we're constantly coming out with new stuff. We have these amazing conversations where Priya, our editorial coordinator, and Sarah Sentry, one of our hosts, sit down and talk about the Phoenix Saga. They call these episodes the Bitches of X. They are fucking incredible, and I hope you will tune in. You also typically get early access to our episodes each week, and other fun stuff. We've done Christmas bonuses. We do interviews that are only available on our Patreon. We provide all the inside scoops before you even know you need them. The whole shebang. We hope you'll join us there. Again, it's patreon.com/queerspec.
I think it's a question we've actually already asked, but I want to ask it in a slightly different way, which is, I would love to know more about, like, the timeline of this book, in terms of, like, because you've kind of hinted that it had a difficult journey to publication, and you mentioned, like, when it first started, like, when you first conceived, like, okay, this is when I have to start writing this story. Although it sounds like you were thinking about that story for a long time before you were ready to, like, you know, I don't want to use a gun metaphor, like, snap the rubber band or whatever. So I'm doing my best here. So I would love to know more about, like, the timeline of this book between, like, first conception until now, and, like, the process, if you feel comfortable about publication, editing, all of that, because it sounds like you had a really fascinating journey. Sorry, Essie, I've been sitting on that, and I just, you know me.
Impulsive, no,
so. Please. So the book itself, and I mean, the contents of the book itself, let's see, the last entry is 2019. And the first entry was, what did I say, 2016? But yes, I obviously a lot of these things happened before then. Yes, January 7th, 2016. And the last one is, 2019, May 23rd, 2019. And, gosh. So that first book in my young adult trilogy for Life on Earth. It's called Losing the Girl. That book was really about Jodi. I had just found out at that point the real reason that she stopped being my friend. And I was going through it. Not just found out. It's because that happened in 2009 or the end of 2008. And I started working on Life on Earth like 2 years later. So I guess it was 2011. Actually, no, it might have been closer to 2009. Anyway, I conceived of the Life on Earth series pretty close to when that was happening. And I absolutely was not ready to talk about it. I was not ready to process it. I was just fuming. My whole life seemed like a lie. All my friendships were suspect. All my relationships were suspect. Like, I was going through it. I was just devastated. But also, like, all these exciting things were happening to me. I was about to get published for the first time. My career was taking off. I just got married or was just about to get married. So, a lot of good things were happening, but like that kind of like my relationship with Jodi that had happened many, many years before that. But finding out the reality of what had been going on that whole time, just pretty much ruined it all. I was just not happy. I went from being like the happiest person on earth to being so freaking miserable and paranoid, and it was terrible, a terrible time. But clearly I needed to process it in some way. And the concept of Life on Earth, where I draw each chapter from a different protagonist's point of view, was sort of my way to try to see things from her perspective. So one of the characters is very closely based on her, although as I wrote the book and then eventually wrote the series, it became less and less about her. And so that went away, as it often does when you base fiction on reality. In the very beginnings of that, I was like, how does she see the world? How does she see our friendship? Both literally and figuratively, which is why I was trying out the different styles of artwork for each person. So that was like the beginning of me kind of trying to write about it. It took another 7 years before I actually was ready to just write about it. And I'd been trying for a long time to let it go up to that point. So that's how the behind the scenes of the book happens. I mentioned before, I kind of want to go back to it about finding visual metaphors to work with in the book. Because once I kind of figured out like, okay, this green plant is going to represent Jodi. And the roses represent my faith in Jodi, and the lilacs represent memory. Like once I started like nailing those ideas down, and like the corkboard is like me trying to figure things out. So there are all these visual metaphors, and some of them are more intuitive and some of them are just like literal where I'm like, okay, this is what this means. Other ones are things that just felt right.
You're just blowing my fucking mind. Everything you're saying, I'm like, oh my God, of course. Yes, and that must have meant that. Continue. Sorry. I was just like,
me
like,
too.
They're very obvious. And I'm like, well, then I'm a fool is what I am. Because
No, I never explain it. And I don't, I'm hoping that people pick up on it, like just as they're reading it intuitively, but like don't need an explanation. And it's fine. Like I don't expect anyone to get it at all because it's I never explain it.
I'm mostly goofing because I definitely you get those things without having. That's what I think makes comics, makes visual art, makes graphic memoir so different, is you can play with our subconscious with what we know to mean. Like you were just saying, you were like, oh, the roses represent, say it again for me.
My faith in Jodi.
Well, and I called those your rose-colored glasses. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's not exactly how you'd put it, but I can see the connection between those things.
Very similar.
Yeah. So yes. I didn't get it, but part of me got it. But it's just so fun to hear you, you know, reveal what they meant to you. And then I'm like, oh, I have to go read it again.
So that scene that you mentioned before about the bright red flowers, I'm not going to say exactly what that meant, but those were when I was using bright red colors. I was often trying to express anger or fury, but also like deception. Like there are a lot of different, I mean, they're kind of interchangeable. So it's not all like one thing necessarily, but yeah.
I didn't understand that. And at the same time, I still loved it. And I think that's one thing about, I think the art, it's so compelling. Like it obviously feels very meaningful. And I think I like felt an emotion when I saw it. I don't think that I understood it like on an intellectual level. But I still like very much enjoyed it. So obviously your like, I don't want to call it because I don't do art, but like visual eye or your visual choices are resonant on a subconscious level, even when they're not, even when I don't know what things mean.
Mm-hmm. That was what I was hoping for. Like, honestly, I don't want to have people be like, oh, well, what does this mean? And what does that mean? And like for them to like step out of the experience of the book. Like I want it to kind of seep in and give them a feeling. Like that's ultimately what the visuals are for, is to give them a feeling.
Mm. You know, someone's going to like write like a grad school paper on this at some point. And I just hope they listen to this episode because it's really going to help them out is all I'm saying. It's all I'm saying. You know, something that we talked about off the air and I realized it wasn't actually on in the interview yet is that Maria and I both found this book just unputdownable. Like just, you know, I think, yeah. You know, Maria, you tell about your experience, Maria, and then I'll jump in of like reading it.
Well, like all people with ADHD, I overscheduled myself like a week after debut. And I was like, I can't accomplish my life right now. So I knew I had to read this book before this interview. And I hadn't actually heard of you before because I'm not really well connected to anything. I'm like culturally bereft at all times, but I'm working on it. And it's true. I grew up in the middle of nowhere and I'm like kind of integrating with society right now. It's a process. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to like set a small goal, because that's one thing I've been trying to do with ADHD, right? It's like, what's the smallest possible step? Just do that step. And then sometimes it helps with the executive functioning. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to read like one chapter, not having no idea how long chapters are in this book or whatever. But the way that it's structured makes it so addictive. I mean, it's addictive for a lot of reasons, but the way that it's structured, it's almost like it taps into that part of my psychology, at least, that's kind of like the infinite scroll on Twitter. Like each page or presentation is a self-contained story, right? Like there's, you know, you have the visual piece, you've got like the written piece that, again, like every single page kind of has its own little story. It almost stands alone. And so I kept saying like, okay, well, just one more. Well, just one more. Well, just one more. And the next thing, I was doing it on my phone. So I was scrolling up just like I was on Twitter or Instagram or something. Wow. And suddenly it was over, right? Because I had read like for four or five, I don't know how long because I'm time blind, but like, you know, I sat down and then, you know, I read a whole book and it was just so addictive and I just couldn't put it down. And I remember thinking the whole time, like I wish I knew who you were, that in a way that I could contact you and just like live tweet this whole book to you and like all my reactions and feelings, because I was having a lot of reactions. And it's the kind of book that you want to talk to people about. Like it's immediately generative of conversation, right? So I'm like enjoying it. I can't put it down. And I also want to talk to somebody. So that was my experience.
Yeah. And mine was, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to read, you know, a couple, you know, I'll read 100 pages. I knew it was longer than that. I was like, if I read 100 pages, I'm fine. And I don't even remember how many I got to, but it was like the middle of the night. I was like, I must go to sleep. I need sleep. And so I slept, but then I woke up. I couldn't, the only thing on my mind was, I thought you loved me. I was like, I have to read it. Or I'm not going to be able to function today. I need to finish it because it is so compelling. And, you know, I, at the top of the show, I made a joke about like, you know, it's kind of a gossip rag in some ways, but I meant that as a really like a compliment, because part of what drives us forward is we're like, what the fuck? Like, what happened? Like, wait a minute. And you did this thing where I was like, if I can't wait for my physical copy, when I get it, I will probably, when I reread it, throw the book at that point, because it was like, you were like, and then I figured out what really happened. And then you turn the page and you're like, oh, wait a minute, let me tell you about. And I was like, oh my God, I can't stop it. I need to, oh my God.
I had the exact same reaction. I'm telling you, like I had the word for word, in the exact same point of the book, the exact same reaction. Like I am there with you.
That makes me so happy.
Which is why I was so shocked when you were like, oh, well, I didn't really structure that part. It just kind of came out, because like, hey, I write thrillers. And if reviews are like anything, supposedly the plotting is pretty good, right? And I've worked really a lot on thriller plot. I thought this was like a really thrilling plot. Like, It's not like a, you know, murder. It's like a little bit more contained than that. But like, you know, the twists are huge, and the change in stakes, and like just the way each twist makes you go back and look at everything you read until that moment and like see it in a whole new way. I couldn't believe, like, I'm so jealous. Like, I'm so unbelievably jealous.
That part, I mean, I don't know. I did know what I was doing with that particular moment in the book. But also I got into that moment of writing it and I'm like, wait, I do have to explain the whole Gary thing. And so that was
oh my God,
genuine.
Gary.
I have to explain Gary. Like he just kind of pops out of nowhere. And I'm like, wait, no, you need to know the context. Because if you don't know the context of it, then you don't understand what's mm-hmm. at stake. So yeah, I definitely, like, even though I knew what I was doing as hook wise, like it still was pretty organic.
But it was nice too, because it's this moment of like, oh my God, poor Mari. You know, that's what you're just thinking. You're just like, Mari, how are you going to make it through this one? Like you are just getting the shit kicked out of you by relationships. Like, I hate this. And then you give us this like, and then there was Gary. And we're like, oh, thank God. Like, oh, wow. You know, Mari deserves a break. And it feels so good, because I think in memoir, something that people, I think, struggle with is like putting someone in too much danger without a sense of like, are they okay? Because they're real people, right? It's not characters. Because if you kill off a character, people are like, I'm sad, but you know, you made him up, so fine. But like, to know that you were actually like, okay, we're going to go to a much darker place, but first, I want you to know I'm okay. You know, it's like that moment. And I was like, oh, relief. I mean, I knew you were okay because, again, because I'm a super fan. But it was nice to have it in the narrative, because it was, the tension was so high at that point. We were like, ah!
Yeah, it was.
You know, so to be like, we're cool. That was a nice thing.
I mean, that's how I feel like about my life, though. Oh, Gary,
we awesome. Love Gary. We love Gary.
He's pretty great. He's pretty great.
So good. Well, Maria, did you have any more questions about I Thought You Loved Me?
I know you wanted to talk about the publishing
yes.
aspect.
I would love to hear about, as a person who's very salty about publishing at all times, which it's been pretty nice to me lately, but I'll never stop being salty. Like I would love to hear it.
So yeah, this isn't my first book. And I knew from when I was trying to sell Life on Earth, how freaking hard it is to sell anything that hasn't been done yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like people, like the bigger publishers, especially, they want something that's tried and true. They want, and even if you're like a known quantity, they still want something that they know is going to sell. So they don't want anything that's like different or pioneering or, you know, trying new things. Or if it is, it has to be really subtle. And this book obviously is pretty weird. Like it's like, and I say that, I mean, I like weird, so I don't find that self-deprecating, but it's unusual, just purely in like how it's presented. I mean, it's sort of comics. There's comics, but it's not exactly comics. And, you know, it's definitely a new thing-ish. I mean, other people have tried new things. It's not completely unique, but it's unique enough that it was very, very, very difficult to find a publisher for. And I did. So this one publisher, an LGBTQ press, eventually picked it up, and I was very excited about that. And then all this pandemic stuff happened, where basically some of the places that they'd gotten quotes from, they wouldn't honor the quotes.
Oh man.
Some of them rescinded their quotes, did like a no bid because they had run out of paper,
oh my
like
God.
Run out of the
and
it was to the point where they showed me the paper, they showed me the numbers, and they're like, okay, if we print this, we're gonna have to sell, I don't know, thousands of books. And then after that, you know, to make the money back, and after that, we're gonna get like 12 cents a book.
Wow.
And they're like, you know, this is not viable right now. And they were really sad about it and said, look, and you know, they'd spent a lot of time helping me, you know, arrange the book, and like we spent a lot, many, many hours together. So it's not like they didn't have anything invested in this, but they're just like, you know, we can either wait until like the world of paper gets better, or we can give you your rights back. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, find another home for it. And I was pretty devastated.
Yeah,
obviously.
I can't imagine you wouldn't be.
And this was, you know, in the middle of the pandemic. other things that happened in the pandemic that, like, for one, I was having some pretty bad mental health crises due to, for many, you know, many factors. I think a lot of people were having problems. I happened to be in the middle of a horrible neighbor situation.
Oh my God.
That was so bad. I followed on Instagram. It was bad. You had bad times.
I would read a memoir of a horrible neighbor situation, FYI. Like that, it is so stressful.
Writing about it. Oh my God.
And
I had to have a therapy session and she's like, you're not ready.
Oh my God.
I'm on Lexapro. I am in a safe place. I moved out of that situation. It's been a year and I was doing research because I'm like, oh yeah, this is going to be a great story. And I suddenly, like, after, I don't know, I was working on the book for like 6 hours one day. I'm just like, you know, I was in the zone where I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do this. And I suddenly felt so unsafe. I was in the middle of it again. I was in the middle of a fucking panic attack, even though I'm on Lexapro. You can bleep that off if you want. But it all came back to me and it was like, I was there and I'm like, oh shit, no, I can't, you know, there's like, it physically felt like I was there again. I experienced some anti-Asian racism during the pandemic. Like, and I developed like a, I think it was like a panic disorder, like all sorts of bad things were happening, during the pandemic. And also my career, kind of got halted during that. Like, I mean, I will spare you the details, but like basically that I was beginning a book tour to finally tour my young adult trilogy, the month that everything shut down. So I managed to get it and everything got canceled. And I feel like if it had happened later, I would have done the virtual circuit that everyone was doing. But by that point, it's kind of too late, or I don't know. Like I never got to promote it. The book sold so bad. They pulped my books before I even got my old author's copies. Like it was.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Wait, this has a happy ending.
Please. I'm like, do I need to go fight someone? Cause I'm ready.
No, I mean, I think the pulping might have been an accident, or I don't know what exactly what happened, but like the books were not selling. And I heard all sorts of reasons for it. Like, I know people who had books that sold really well during the pandemic, but for whatever reason, this specific genre for this specific age group, at least this is what my agent and other people told me, well, like this, you were in a bad spot for this. And basically, I thought my career was over because if your books don't sell,
you don't get another one.
Well, if you get another one, you're not going to get paid like very much. Basically, it's like I had gone back a decade and I'm like, I can't start over.
I'm about to have a panic attack right now.
It was really messed up. I even told my agent, like we had some pitches out. I even had some finished books out and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Could you pull my pitches? Like I had like a big publisher interested in something and I'm like, no, I can't actually, I'm done. Like I quit comics. And of course, you know, he was upset. He didn't say he was upset, but I can tell, like, you know, he'd been working hard on these pitches and I'd been working with a big publisher on a pitch and I'm just like, I can't do this. And then the first book in that series got banned in Katy, Texas.
You said happy ending. I just want to put that out there. I'm going to hold you to it because it seems like things are getting worse and not better.
No, it gets worse before it gets better. But so it got banned. And then I'm like, wow, insult to injury. Like, this really sucks. Oh my gosh. But because it got banned and because people noticed that it got banned, and here's the thing, not every banned book actually gets noticed that it's banned, but because I was lucky enough to have it noticed and written up in the LA Times. And then one of my best friends called me and she's like, my boyfriend saw you were banned in the LA Times. I'm like, what? So that restarted my career. And suddenly those books were back in print. My other books, which I didn't realize were out of print, were suddenly back in print. And now I'm just like going forward. And now I have another big book deal with a big publisher who convinced me to keep going with that book. But I'm like, I'm not going to draw it. And so they said, okay, well, if you find an illustrator. So I've got a book coming out with Trung Ling Nguyen.
What?
In 2026.
What? Two of my fucking favorite people. Are you kidding me? I am losing it.
With Little Brown in 2026. So like,
and Trung's art is so good. I cannot wait to see it. Oh my God, I'm so excited.
I could not believe that Chong said yes. Like, I'm just like, and they were the first person I asked. And because I'm like, well, I gotta ask like my dream illustrator first, even though Chong is like way much bigger star than me. Like, they said yes. So anyway, happy ending. My career is back on track, but man, that was a close call. So anyway, so all this is happening during all the bad stuff before the book banning, which was also bad.
Dark times.
Very dark time. And so then on top of like my books being pulled, my career being over, also I lose my small press who's going to publish this book. And I'm like, okay, yeah, this freaking sucks. Now, there, Rob Klo, who's a comics critic for the Comics Journal, he's a good friend, like, you know, over time, like, you become good friends with pretty much everyone in the industry. Like, that's just what happens. Like, everyone knows each other. And I had asked him to look at the book right after I'd written it because I'm like, I don't know if this is good or not. You know, I think it was even before. Yeah, it was before I even had the publisher. I just said, Rob, could you look at this? He also has a business where he reviews people's books and he's got a very reasonable rate. And you know, and gives you feedback as a comics critic. And he was going through some hard times. So I'm like, oh, I'll give him some work. And I had him look at it and he came back and said, this is your best work.
Oh.
And I was like, oh shit, really? Like, this is like, it's, you know, I needed to hear that. And I think a week later I got the publisher. And so he said that, and he's like, you know, if you ever want to publish something with Field Mouse, which is a publisher that he and a couple people had just started, like right at the beginning of the pandemic or like right before the pandemic. It's like, if you ever want to publish something with us, like, I know like it's crowdfunding. I know you're not into that, but like, you know, keep us in mind. I'm like, yeah. So I got the publisher that fell through after, I don't know, 6 months, a year. And in that time I'd gotten some really good, blurbs. I got a blurb from Alexander Chi. I asked Rob Klo for a blurb since I knew he liked it already and he'd read the book. So he like gave me that, the feedback, and he gave me a blurb. And then when I'm like, oh damn, what am I going to do with the book? I went back to him and I'm like, would you want to publish this book? And he was like, hell yeah.
Amazing.
And so he became my publisher and he's the hero of this book. I mean, he made this book happen. Like, he kept me going and he made the book happen. And yeah, he's my editor now.
Yeah, Rob! Like, woo!
Yeah, amazing. And yeah.
I can't believe I have three other things that happened to you during the pandemic to bring up. Like, I can't believe you did all of that. And I know of three, like, I personally know of three others. One is, I wanted to hear a little bit about the mural that went up in the Bay Area. I'd love to hear about that.
Oh, so that's in Los Angeles.
Oh, I'm sorry. In Los Angeles.
That's okay. And that was, so I was still living there and I was still going through all the horrible, the horrible neighbor stuff. Which someday will be a book once I could stop having panic attacks about it. and yeah, that was a weird situation because, the person who contacted me about it, like, contacted me through a DM on Instagram. I think it was Instagram, maybe it was Twitter. And so already I'm like, is this legit? And she's like, oh yeah, we are the same people who did like Shepherd Fairey's Hope poster. And like, I Googled her. I couldn't find much information about it. I'm like, is this a scam? Are they going to ask me for my credit card information or like my bank information lately? But I'm like, okay, they're offering me a lot of money and it's for like LA healthcare. And like, it seems like a good message. And so actually it wasn't until they unveiled the mural that I was entirely sure I wasn't being scammed by a Nigerian prince. Seriously. Now, this might give you some insight into my mental state at the time where I was in this paranoid state, like on top of everything. Maybe that had something to do with it, but like, we were in contact. The work was very, very hard. It was the first time I've worked with the government. So I didn't I've never gone through those levels of bureaucracy before. It was a very difficult 3 weeks of creating this art. And then they unveiled it. And I hadn't really left the house except to maybe go pick up like to store, like the Whole Foods pickup where they deliver your groceries to you, but like, and going to parks, but like, I hadn't really seen my friends in, it felt like forever. Like I just felt really isolated and I was surrounded by people who hated me, which were my neighbors. So it was a really horrible, dark time. And I just felt inherently unlovable. And just, and also I was having panic attacks all the time and I was terrified of getting sick. I still am. but like, it was just a really horrible time. And then she's like, well, can you come out to the dedication ceremony? I'm like, okay. It was outdoors. Everyone was in masks. I don't know like how much we knew about the pandemic at that point, but like the vaccines had just come out. So I did it and suddenly I was surrounded by all these people who loved me. I mean, they didn't know me, but like who loved the art that I put up and who were just so happy to have like an Asian person talking about like anti-Asian hate and like things that had happened, which is what my pandemic was about. I mean, which is what the mural was about, which is about like, we're going through a hard time right now, but like, look, this is not the first time that Asian Americans have faced hardships, like, and we've gone past it and look at all these wonderful people who helped us get past it. I mean, so it's a comic book or a comic, but in mural form. And so they opened this mural and it was just such, it was so good. It felt so good. Like I was crying under my mask the whole time. So I felt so welcome. You just had so much community out. And then they, people loved it so much that they did another mural. I think there's four of the exact same mural in various parts of LA County. And they did like, they plastered posters of it up everywhere. It was like 500 posters of this artwork I'd made. And like, oh man, it's brought me so much joy. The actuality of it was so hard. And I was so worried that I was getting scammed. But like in the end, like it just was so refreshing. And also after that, I'm like, I don't know, should I still be making comics? Cause this was such a good experience and I'm getting so much good feedback. And I only spent 3 weeks on this as opposed to 10 years. So I'm still not entirely sure I'm in the wrong profession because that felt pretty amazing. Like I still have like people like pose in front of it for Instagram or whatever. And like I got so many just heartfelt emails from young Asian parents who like brought their kids to see it and had their first conversation about racism with their kids.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
All this like, amazing stuff. I'm like, I don't know that all of my books have had this kind of impact on anyone. But so yeah, that's the story of the murals.
Can I just say one thing I find super inspirational about you is the fact that you just do so many different things. Like, I don't know how else to put that, but like, obviously as a person with ADHD, I lack focus and I'm constantly falling in love with some new hobby or thing that I want to do. And there's this very real narrative in our culture that like people should pick a thing and get really, really good at it and then like monetize the thing and then just keep doing that. Right. And you're just so like wonderfully successful in all of these different areas and you're just so authentic and you clearly love like experimenting in all these different areas and mediums and things like that. And I'm like, oh, I want to grow up and be like, I mean, I'm grown up, but you know what I mean? Like, I want to grow up and do that. You know, it sounds amazing.
But you can, I get bored. Like that's part of the thing. Like, I don't want to keep doing the same thing again and again. Like, and that's kind of the problem with this specific capitalist society is like, people see that you make something that's successful and they're like, okay, do that 100,000 times. I'm like, no, I've already done it. I'm ready to move on.
Which brings me to a book you wrote and published, or at least published during the pandemic, which is Dirty Produce. And I do not hear people talk about it very often. I got it because it was you. And like I said, super fan. And I gave it to my partner, who's a chef, for like a gift. And we die laughing all the time. We just like look at it and then just laugh and laugh and laugh. So I would love to hear a little bit, like if you want to tell our listeners what Dirty Produce is about. And then, you know, what was this lighthearted process like in the midst of all this intensity?
Can I just say it? Like, as soon as you said that, I Googled it and I can see the pictures and I'm dead. Like, I've already purchased this. Like, I was like instant clicking as you were talking. I was like, oh my God, look at these avocados. Like, what is happening here?
I mean, of all, like, I know I do memoir, but I feel like of all the books that I've done, like, that Dirty Produce is, like, the most, like, that's me. It's just, I feel like it's just dorky and silly and just stupid and sexy. Fun. Like,
let me read this. Please let me read this. Okay. Eating your fruits and veggies sounds so wholesome, but is it? Discover a world of lusty lemons, erotic eggplants, cauliflowers that can't keep their florets to themselves, and peppers doing things you've never dreamed possible with mutual enthusiastic consent. Of course. Like, this is amazing. This is, I think you've just cured racism. I don't know. Like, this is the most amazing, like, I'm dead. Like, I'm absolutely dead. Like, this is the book we all needed and we didn't even know we needed.
Yeah, I feel like this book really reflects my day-to-day personality. Like, if you know me, then this is the book that you're like, oh, that's Mari. Whereas, my memoirs can be kind of serious or whatever. And it's not that I don't have that side of me, but, like, I'm just a big dork. Like,
a fruit and vegetable dork.
I did not write that copy, although I did insist that they add, like, enthusiastic mutual consent or whatever.
That's my favorite part. And I'm a vegan, by the way. So, like, I'm like, yeah, dirty produce. Like, yeah, like, I don't.
It was just such a gift to get that lighthearted, funny, oddly sexy book in the midst of, like, it's been a rough couple of years. And it really wasn't.
Oh my God, you're right. Gift. I'm going to buy another one right now. I know someone who needs this in their life.
Perfect.
Hey. Yeah, years ago, I think it was like 2016 or what, 2015, early on when I moved to Los Angeles, I was part of the Post-it note show at Giant Robot. They do it every year. A bunch of, like, hundreds of artists send them Post-its and they sell for like 20 or 30 bucks. I think it's 30 now. And people get really creative with it. And every year I'm like, what am I going to draw on a Post-it? And I drew with some whiteout and a pen, I drew a banana blushing. And I was like, why is that banana blushing? And then I just drew, like, I don't know, six more, eight more fruits, like, doing kind of being a little sexy. And I'm like, and it just made me laugh. I'm like, oh, this is so fun. And because of that, I made a little scene. And so all these people who are like, oh, I like your work, but I really like that zine you made, which is completely like different than anything I'd ever done. And so it was just like a fun thing. And I think it was my agent who's like, you should really expand this. This should be a book. I'm like, and like everyone was like, oh, you should make stickers. You should make t-shirts. I'm like, yeah, I'm not really a merch person. That's too much work for me. I don't want my house filled with t-shirts, you know? So anyway, that was just one of the many things that my agent was pitching. And one day, the person from the New Yorker, Emma from the New Yorker, reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to submit anything to us? And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. And I'm like, what if I submit this my dirty produce? And eventually it ran on the New Yorker's Daily Shouts. It took like a year, though, for us to negotiate the contract. And by us, I mean me and my agent. I love having an agent. Everyone should have an agent because you don't want to get screwed by big corporations whose contracts just only protect their interests. That's all I'm going to say on the subject, but it took about a year. And then finally that ran. And like, I feel like within a week or maybe a month, I had a publisher for it. A publisher that had apparently turned it down prior, because for whatever reason, I think she didn't think it was very funny. But
they were
publishing houses have a high turnover.
I'm looking at this three-bean salad with the beans just like making out. I'm like losing my mind. I can't even breathe. There's a pear sitting on the toilet and there's a cucumber peeking at the pear through a wall and it says a pickle for your thoughts. I'm dying. I can't breathe. This three bean salad is sending me. Like, I can't.
So the idea that someone didn't think it was funny, unacceptable.
Like, what is wrong with that person? It's not acceptable.
Yay. I'm so happy. Now Dirty Produce is probably my favorite book to make. Like, I had so much fun. I was just laughing the whole time.
It's so much fun. It's so much fun.
This makes me want to learn how to do comics. I'm like, I got to do this. I want to draw things doing dirty things.
Yes, come.
I can't draw. I don't know if that's a good idea.
I can't draw either. Everyone says they can't draw it. No one can draw, but you know, if you could write.
Yeah, you know, I've been sort of trying to teach myself to draw. I used to draw when I was younger. So I'm like, okay, let's get it back. And yeah, I think it's amazing because things like Dirty Produce really do inspire me. They make me think like, wow, you can just be really fucking hilarious.
Aww.
Is this kidney bean farting?
It sure is.
I can't breathe. And the green beans like unzipped itself, so it's like bean pods are coming out. Like.
Yeah, so obviously, listeners, you need Dirty Produce. You didn't know, but now you know.
I just bought like two more copies.
Maria's not going to stop till she has 45 copies.
As the Gen Zers say, this book is now my entire personality.
Well, you know, Mari, it has been so delightful talking with you today. The third thing that I know you're up to during the pandemic is one of the things I want to take some time for you to talk about now, because you have a super cool Patreon where you do diary comics. And that's how you share some of them on Instagram. That's how I've learned about your many, many pets, your interest in fashion, the way you've been navigating the world. And so I was hoping you would talk a little bit about your Patreon, but also I was hoping you would talk a little bit more about how you decided to draw them on the specific paper you're using, because I thought that was really fascinating.
Oh, well, you know, I change it up every so often. I've been doing the diary comics, I think, since 2016, every day. And there was a period after I got my iPad that I'm talking to you on right now. There was a period where I was experimenting on the iPad and started playing around with collage. So there was a period of diary comics that were just entirely collage, which now I know I was just preparing to write this book. But yeah, so that was happening. Right now, in the last, I guess I just bought another one. So in the last 2 years, or last year and now, I'm working on a Hobonichi. And lately, although this last batch hasn't been, but lately I've been using fountain pens that my friend Susie Garamani got me into. I already had some, but she's got me even more into it lately. So yeah, I like experimenting. As I say, like I get really bored easily, and I feel like my Patreon is for my super fans. Like they know way too much about me. But it's also, they kind of see my process as it changes. And it's where I do all of my experimentation when I want other, you know, when I want to share it with other people, which honestly, let's face it, I share everything with everybody.
And where can people find your Patreon?
Oh, patreon.com/MariNaomi, I think it is.
I never would have guessed.
Subscribe for like $5. I think you can read all of my diary comics since 2016. Plus I like comics that I have published elsewhere. If I can get permission, I'll also put that on Patreon. I have like work in progress stuff. That's sort of like where mm-hmm. anything goes. Mm-hmm. Like I post things now and then on Instagram, but like, just because I want to keep staying in the algorithm, and also I try to get more patrons.
Who can say
patrons? No, I'm just making. I don't know.
We're trying to get some more patrons.
Tequila. No, that's not right. That's not right.
So Mari, beyond Patreon, if folks want to find you online or follow you on social media, where can they do so?
MariNaomi.com is my website, and it connects you to all the different places, including my databases. I stopped using Twitter for self-expression. Now I just use it for the occasional, like posting my tour dates, which are coming up for this book. Once Elon Musk bought it, I'm like, this is getting too toxic. I can't support this. So I'm off Twitter for the most part, but I'm still on Instagram. I do occasionally post on Facebook since my mother-in-law is there and that's I love so her. But Patreon, if you want all Mari all the time, Patreon's definitely the way to go.
Fantastic. And listeners, if you didn't have a pen, don't worry. We will make sure to include that in the show notes. Mari, wow. Like what I'm still flabbergasted, and we've been talking for almost an hour and a half. I'm like, wait, I don't even know what it, wait, let's go back to the beginning. I want to talk about it again. I Thought You Loved Me is an incredible, incredible graphic memoir. We haven't even talked about the cover. I'm looking at it right now. I fucking love that cover.
Oh, it is.
It's so amazing. Listeners, this is coming out this month. It comes out on February 22nd. So pre-order it now. You have time. Pre-order I Thought You Loved Me. Let's support Mari Naomi's amazing work. Of course, you still need to pick up Dirty Produce. If you're like Maria, you're going to want to buy 5 to 12 copies, depending on, you know,
who's in your life. I'm going to let you guess a number between 5 and 10. And if you get it right, I'll buy that many more copies. Like, because that's where we're at right now. I'm like, I'm trying to think of people who don't need this in my life.
Absolutely perfect. Maria, thank you for being here with us today. Can you let folks know where they can find you online and on social?
Yes, I am everywhere on social media. I'm on Twitter at Maria Dong Writes. I am on Instagram at Maria_Dong_Writes because I somehow accidentally reserved Maria Dong Writes and now can't get back into it. I'm on TikTok at Maria Dong Writes. I'm on Mastodon at Maria Dong Writes at wandering.shop. I don't use any of these with regularity, so good luck.
Oh, I do have a TikTok too. I just post tea review videos and me picking up garbage on the beach. So it's
not. I love it. Multifaceted, as we know. Well, this has been, I what a wonderful way to spend this time. You are both huge lights in my life, very different ways, but I love your work.
We are these three beings. We're these three beings.
I'm a part.
Oh, and I think that's the show, folks. Have a great day.
Can we call this one Three Beans in a Pod? No, I'm kidding. Doesn't even make sense.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Bitches on Comics is a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them most in comics and pop culture, as you probably guessed. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at @bitchesoncomics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes and check out all the other shit we have on our tabs. I don't know what all is there, but enjoy.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor, and you can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at essiefleenor.com.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com. Or on Twitter at Audrey Revenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
If you like Bitches on Comics, you might also enjoy our narrative fiction podcast, Decoded Horror Channel, available wherever you get your podcasts and at dakotapride.com. Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories due to colonization.